Thank you. Let me step in front of the picture of my great-grandfather and say hello to the webcam so my daughters at home can see me if they miss me. I'm sure if they hang on for a few minutes and hear the physics, they won't miss me anymore. And then let me thank the organizers, of course, for the invitation to come to this nice meeting and come to this nice place. I look forward to stay for another week and have interactions and discussions with people here. Jason called me a few weeks ago at 5 in the morning, his local time, to ask me if I would talk about quantum information related issues at this meeting, and I gratefully accepted this kind invitation, and the title was as Chiara just said. Let me first start showing you a citation that I found in a biography about Charles Babbage. He wrote what's called the Ninth Bridgewater Treatise. There were 8 Bridgewater treatises invited by the Duke of Bridgewater, and Charles Babbage made his own. I don't know if it was as a protest against the other very religious treatises written, but he wrote this fantastic statement that really made me jump in the chair. Every atom impressed with good and with ill retains at once the motions which philosophers and sages have imparted to it, mixed and combined in 10,000 ways with all that is worthless and base. The air is one vast library on whose pages are forever written all that man has ever said or woman whispered. So this is in fact very much related to what many of us are doing experimentally or theoretically in our work with atoms. If you look at this is from a point of view of quantum information and precision measurements, of course, you have the philosophers and sages that act on your atoms, and then you get something good out. In quantum information, we fear incoherence, decoherence effects and losses, and that's of course what is worthless and base. And it's really a modern statement. Of course, having 2 daughters myself, I would probably not say woman whispered down here, but apart from that, it's very precise. Babbage is not just anybody. So Babbage often comes up in quantum information talks because he's, of course, the inventor of the Babbage difference engine and the Babbage analytical engine. So it was his design for a computer in 1832, a really ingenious programmable design that could do just everything. It's not because it can only do subtraction that is called the difference engine. In fact, it does power series to very high orders, does any kind of functions you want, and it's really a tricky device. And I could talk a long time about Babbage because reading this biography, you see, he's a really fascinating person. But come and ask me afterwards if you want to hear about the context where he actually put the citation, for example. So let me go to the physics talk. So we'll be a little bit down in this corner, but of course quantum information is strongly correlated with research in quantum gases and many body physics in general, and the connections between these fields have been pointed out in several talks. I think at this meeting we see much more many body physics than we have done at previous quantum gas conferences. You see how formalism and phenomena from many body physics, also the more complicated formalism and phenomena, are now invading our community, and what we can hopefully pay back is fantastic test benches for some of these effects. We have new experimental possibilities and of course also new questions and answers that are coming out of this research. From the quantum gas down to the quantum information, we have physical implementation possible, so we can actually realize, as Ignacio Chirac was talking about, different schemes for computing uses quantum gases as the input, quantum computing, probing, storage, entanglement, and all these properties that we can impose on cold atoms. And going the other way from quantum information research, we have, of course, some deal of motivation. So this is one of the lines in your money application that you can do quantum computing one day. But there are also some tricks from quantum information that we can now see drift into quantum gas research. And then from many body physics to quantum information, we have again the physical implementation. There are also theoretical methods for many body physics now coming into quantum information. And the other way, we have lots of properties that we learn about in quantum information that have not been pointed out so strongly in many body physics before. So there's, for example, what I call new order here. There are not only questions of correlations over distance in many body physics systems, but also, of course, the question whether parties are entangled at long distances. And Ignacio Chirac has done quite a lot of work and looking at some of Haldane's work and see how new states actually of many body matter can be related to entanglement rather than correlation issues only. Then new classical algorithms. By classical algorithm, I mean algorithms that can be carried out on a normal computer that can solve many body problems that we have learned about from the quantum information research. So Guifré Vidal at Caltech has been looking at entanglement properties and found out that in fact you can efficiently solve large spin systems by a method which in some regimes is the same as the density matrix renormalization group theory, but it can in fact do more. It can do time-dependent calculations, and it's I would call that a new theoretical contribution to many-body physics. And then, of course, there is the quantum analog computer. I tried to sell the name RISC some years ago, the reduced instruction set quantum computer that can do simulation of physical systems that happen to look like the atomic system you're dealing with. So there's, of course, a good cross-fertilization between these different fields. And I'm not going to spend the whole talk just commenting on all these connections. That would be this traditional bad compromise of saying something which is trivial for those who already knew it and which would be incomprehensible for those who didn't. So I will in fact try to focus on one direction of research in which we do quantum information with states with many, many atoms, and I will talk about entanglement, spin squeezing and precision probing as examples. When I say in collaboration here, this is people with whom I've been working over the past years, and I wouldn't make them responsible for anything I say here, but there's a lot of input from discussions with these people that goes into this talk today. So one of the things that I would like to talk about is actually what happens to a quantum system when you do measurements on it. Okay, and so we already know and we use a lot the kind of states we can produce by having a Hamiltonian. And in the quantum gas cases, we have the nonlinearity, which can give rise to interesting quantum optical or quantum information-related properties of systems. We heard Mark Kasevich using interactions, of course, to make squeezing-type states. But there's another way in which you can make very interesting states that has not been discussed at this meeting so much. That is having a quantum system, performing a measurement on the same quantum system, and obtaining a new state of that quantum system which is conditioned upon your measurement. Okay, so this is the standard description of what's sometimes called a Feynman measurement. You perform a projection operator on the state of the system. It has an index on it, and that index corresponds exactly to the outcome of your measurement. So it's random, the outcome that you get in such a measurement, and what you get here can be very interesting. The system must, of course, for this to be interesting, must, of course, be intact after the measurement. So there's no fun in doing a Stan Gerlach measurement of an atom if the atom is absorbed on some kind of photographic film. But if you can do a measurement which keeps physical system intact, or at least part of the system intact, then this is an interesting way to engineer dynamics. And of course, in quantum sets, by doing probing of your quantum set, we can engineer states of matter. You can, an example I see as an important example is the one of interference between different quantum sets, where a priori there is no interference fringe, but when you start probing, this kind of theory immediately tells you how the interference signal should come up. Okay, if you want to use this in practice, you have to have a plan, because the outcome is random. So you have to decide or make a situation in which you know what to do given the outcome of the measurement. It could be, for example, that you are only interested in the outcomes where you got a certain result, and otherwise you just re-prepare the system and try again. Or in other cases, you can accept perhaps all outcomes, but you have to remember the outcome, because you have to know what state you actually prepared for it to be useful in future application. So this is something, this particular scenario, that I will talk about quite a lot, and this is going to be in the case where I use light to probe an atomic system. Let me give you a very simple example. I had decided not to give this example, but then it's linked to what's called the Caprillo scheme in quantum computing, and I saw a road called the Caprillo Boulevard not far from here, so I figured that's a sign, so I have to show it anyway. And it's so imagine that you have a single two-level atom with two stable ground state, hyperfine states, and you take an optical probe that is non-resonantly interacting on the F2, the excited state transition here. That probe will be phase-shifted if the atom is in the state F, but it's not going to be phase-shifted if the atom is in G. So by measuring the phase shift of a field that has passed by this atom, you can learn whether it is in F or G. And if it's prepared in a superposition, the measurement will project it onto be in F or G, depending on whether you see the phase shift or no phase shift. Okay, so that's a simple mechanism. And with that mechanism, we can also entangle pairs of atoms. So here I put a pair of atoms, and I probe them the same way. I put them in a cavity to have sufficiently strong interaction with the atoms, sufficiently large phase shift. And I initially prepare a product state of superposition state of both atoms, and now I measure how big is the phase shift. And if the phase shift corresponds to a total number of atoms in this F state being 0 or 2, then I have the product state GD or the product state FF. But if the phase shift corresponds to a number of atoms in the F state being 1, then the projection of that state actually gives me an entangled state. So this is one of the states that people love in quantum information. It's a resource for various purposes. So using here, and that's the important point, using just classical light, a coherent beam of light, shining it onto this system, and reading at the phase of the classical field after transmission through the cavity, you can actually produce an interesting quantum state of an atomic system. Now, I will immediately move to large atomic systems. And I like to show a scheme here where you imagine two large gases. Now, I don't have to put them in cavities because large macroscopic gases can already give significant phase shifts all by themselves. And in both gases, I prepare a superposition of G plus F for all the atoms. So here I have N atoms in that state, and in the other gas, I also have N atoms in that state. And now I again probe, measure the phase shift of the light going through. And what happens is, of course, that the phase shift depends on how many atoms are totally sitting in this F state. So I learn what is the number of atoms in the F state in the first gas plus the number in the second gas. So the two gases will become entangled this way. And it's going to be measured by this correlation. So this was proposed by Lu Ming Duan and the Innsbruck group some years ago, and it was demonstrated in my university by Eugene Polsik, and he has moved to Copenhagen a year ago, and it also worked, luckily enough, at the Bohr's own institute in Copenhagen. Quantum mechanics is also true over there, so that's good. I should also say we heard in Trey's talk that they moved equipment under vacuum. In fact, Eugene, he moved his apparatus under vacuum as well, 300 kilometers on a truck, but he didn't even take Aarhus air to Copenhagen. It was also under vacuum when he arrived.
Is he the same successful in Copenhagen as in
Aarhus? Yes. I fear that, yes. It would have been nice to see a correlation the other way, but no, it works very well in Copenhagen. So, I like to go to the case of many atoms, both because many atoms is what we are very often dealing with, but also because we have a fantastic good approximation, a very handy formalism by which we can deal with really many atoms and by which we can take many, many effects into account that are very difficult for smaller systems. That's because in the case of many atoms, you have a more or less continuous description of the system. And what we actually have is a description where we can use Gaussian states to describe the system. So I have all these atoms, and now I switch here to a spin notation. So F and G are now spin up and spin down, and everybody put in that superposition state, it means that all the spins are pointing, fictitious spins if you like, are pointing along the x direction, and there's a macroscopic expectation value of the collective spin, which is just half the number of atoms. Okay. The y and the z components of these spins have mean values of 0. And if you look at the fluctuations of these guys, this would be the population difference between the two states. So that's going to be a binomial distribution, and the same for JY. So you have variances of JY and JC, which are just given by the binomial distribution. And that is actually equal to what you see here, this expectation value of JX squared divided by 4. So the reason why I write this is because this is the equality sign in Heisenberg's uncertainty relation for these operators. So the state where you have this spin polarized sample, it's actually, even though you think of it as a very classical state of a macroscopic collection of atoms, it's a deep quantum state. It's a state which exactly is at the limit of Heisenberg's uncertainty relation for these observables. And if you can make a state where, for example, you can reduce the variance of this collective spin JY, then necessarily the other one here has to go up for quantum mechanical reasons. And so it is actually a quantum state, even though it's maybe 10 to the 12 atoms. Maybe it's even room temperature in a paraffin coated cell, as in Eugene's experiment. So this is, of course, very nice. If we renormalize JC with this macroscopic JX expectation value, and we do the same with Y, we get canonical commutator relations. So this is why I call these operators X and P. So these act like a fictitious position and momentum operator representing the atomic state. And we are just in the ground state, or in a minimum uncertainty state for these guys, and these are exactly the Gaussian wave functions in X or P. We can do the same with light. So if you have polarized light, X-polarized light, you have a number of photons, and the Stokes X component here is defined the same way as for atoms, so it's half the number of photons. The Y and C have zero components, so therefore I can exactly the same way define oscillator-like operators describing the polarization state of a macroscopic pulse of light. Okay, and it's also a minimum uncertainty state, so linearly polarized light is in fact a minimum uncertainty state for these polarization components. Now, the interesting thing is the interaction that we're going to impose between atoms and light. So if you have a light beam like this going through a cloud of atoms, here I draw it as if these are actually Siemens sublevels, but you can engineer this in many different ways. Then the sigma plus polarized light and the sigma minus polarized components of your linearly polarized field will act differently, interact differently with the two ground state components. Either you have different Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, or in this case, you even have forbidden transitions. Of course, if you don't have Siemens sublevel sitting out here, you cannot go from this state with sigma minus polarized light. So this difference in interaction between the different atomic states and the different spin or polarization components causes an interaction between this collective spin of the atoms and the collective spin of the photons. And you can, in fact, write it just as the SC times JC, or the P components of the two systems. What this will lead to is it will lead to a polarization rotation of the light given by the macroscopic spin of the atoms. It's known as Faraday rotation, so of course it's a well-known classical effect. So we have states which are Gaussian, we have Hamiltonian, which is bilinear in these operators. And we know that if we have this kind of Hamiltonian, then the Gaussian character of the state will be preserved. So if I make a time evolution of the atomic and field system here, I can continue describing it by a Gaussian state, but of course a new one, a modified one. So now I would have to develop this whole theory for Gaussian states, but it has already been done, and the reason it has been done, also in the recent years, is that Gaussian states have gained importance in entanglement theory. This field of entanglement theory is really very, very difficult. It's very hard to say whether states of quantum systems are entangled or not. There's a lot of lots of theory on that, and it's very open questions, in fact. Yes, okay, so you have to make a definition. So making a definition saying that you're entangled if you're not separable, okay? And you're separable if the density matrix can be written as a sum with positive weights of products of density matrices for the various systems. Such a system could be made by a person with a telephone calling up different agents and asking them to set up different states of the system and tossing coins about which orders he should give these people. So this is something that could be created by purely classical communication. But there's a mathematical definition too, and it doesn't help us because that recipe is so broad and general that it's still almost impossible to test for entanglement if you are given, even as a theorist, if you're given numerically the values of a density matrix for a big system. But that's not true for Gaussian states. So this is a Pussy Galore from the James Bond movie Goldfinger, and she always said, let's slip into something more comfortable. So people in entanglement theory also slipped into something more comfortable, namely the Gaussian states, where things get more comfortable. And so there's a nice literature on Gaussian states, and there are a few papers here by Gitgen and Sirac in particular, and Isard and Plinio, who reviewed what can be done with Gaussian state. So you can steal information out of these papers on how to deal with the Gaussian state. So a Gaussian state is just characterized by only mean values and a covariance matrix. And of course, if you want to use some of this theory, which I think you can, in BEC theory, of course, it corresponds to having the Gross-Bisiewski wave function and the treatment of the Bogoliubov excitations, which are to lowest order. The Gaussian states, I mean, that is the M and the gamma, they just transform under interactions which are bilinear in X's and P's. So that means that if you only have a Hamiltonian that involves terms like that, then you will keep the Gaussian character. Of course, you will get time dependence on these quantities, but it will still be exact and correct that the state is a Gaussian state. And some of the examples that we heard about from in the talks yesterday by Mark Kasevich and Mike Chapman and Klaus Engstock, you had interactions which were exactly this PP type. So the spin dependent interactions or the double wells that Mark were talking about would correspond to such a situation. So you could start out with such a Gaussian theory. And that's the new result, actually, by the people I mentioned before. Gaussian states also transform into Gaussian states under measurements, if you measure X's and P's. That is, if you do Stern-Gerlach-type measurements, if you do homodyne detection of light, you will still get Gaussian states coming out on the other side. So this is really what we want to do. So I will actually not run through the formalism, but the Gaussian state means that the probability distribution for all your variables, x's and p's, is an exponential of a matrix times this vector y minus its mean, and y minus its mean on the left. And for a single variable, it's just the usual Gaussian distribution. So I'll skip a little technical. Let me just show one thing here, actually. If you have the atoms described with a Gaussian distribution, so the projection of this mountain onto the axis down here shows you that the number of atoms populating a certain state is uncertain by some value, and you interact with an optical field, then you will build in a correlation between the field and the atoms. You will have more polarized photons in that direction if there are many atoms, and more in this direction if you have few atoms in a given state. So you build up a correlation in your covariance for the atoms in the fields. And what I indicate with the purple curve is what happens if you now measure the value of the field. So instead of having this 2D distribution, of course, I've just measured the field, so it's only a 1D distribution. But it's also one which has been shifted a little bit compared to the initial one, and it has a narrower width for the atoms than it had before. You have simply learned something about the atoms, so you know where you are within that broad initial distribution. So we can, sending light through atoms in a condensate or warm atoms, you can learn about this collective observable. So here's the mathematics, and I'm sure you're happy that I don't go through it. In fact, instead I will just show you a cartoon. This is one of my very first PowerPoint presentations, so you see I still have to work on technology. But here's the atoms, and here's a light pulse. Here's a covariance matrix which has an atomic part. It has the identity for the atoms, for the photons. That means you have this ground Gaussian state. And there's no correlation because the light is just arriving now. And then, I was happy when that worked out. Then you build in a correlation between the two. You have a new state of the field and also a modified state of the atoms. And then you do the detection. And when you have done the detection, you have again a new state of the atoms condition on what you measured. You have no correlations anymore because the light has gone. But I have put the identity down here again because there's already a new pulse ready to enter and be detected in the subsequent time step. So this is the way we can update these Gaussian states. And the result here would be precisely spin squeezing of the atomic system. That is, you learn something about these atomic distributions. If I put in two gases, I'm not going to do the light through, or at least not in detail, then what you learn is something collective for the two gases, and then you get the entanglement of the samples. And this is precisely Eugene Polsik's experiment in Aarhus and now also Copenhagen. So in a continuous limit where you probe very frequently, where the pulses are very weak, or you look at very short segments of a CW beam, then the update becomes continuous. Only very little happens to the atoms, of course. So in fact, you get a differential equation for the description of the atomic system. It's a nonlinear equation. In fact, it looks a bit like the Gauss-Pitevsky equation in some limits. It's called the Riccati equation, and Riccati exactly worked it out for condition probabilities centuries ago. And sometimes it can even be solved analytically, so we actually know precisely what happens to the system due to the probing. So the example of spin squeezing, for example, is such a case. If I look at the variance of the P atom, meaning actually the variance of the population difference between the two ground states in the atomic gas, when I probe, the Kappa squared indicates the intensity of the probing field, then I have a reduction which is a constant times the same variance squared. So this is the nonlinear equation I have to solve. And here's the solution, which has been verified experimentally by Eugene, that the variance, the number difference between these two internal states in the atoms will drop as this function of time. So that's very nice. And you can add in atomic decay, and if you do that, the equation gets worse. You can still solve it, but you don't want to see the solution. But you can really learn a lot about the dynamics of these systems. The update of the covariance matrix is deterministic. So that's a property of the Gaussian function. So no matter where I put my purple outcome of the field measurement, actually the width and the atomic state is the same. But there's something which is not the same, and that's the displacement. That's the point at which the mean value is located. So starting out with a distribution for my atoms, if I learn that the set component is positive, I mean, I get a better and better knowledge about it, but it can end up at random place within the original distribution. So that's why you do not only have to do the measurement, you also have to actually do the measurement and remember the outcome. Otherwise, there's no help in knowing that your original broad distribution has become a narrow distribution, but you don't know where it is. I mean, that's the same as a broad distribution. So here's a
just shows it's a sequence of measurements that you get once they add.
Yes, this could be as a function of time. So a little bit later, my distribution now looks like this, and a little bit later it looks like this. And the reason it's actually a circle going into an ellipse is because I show both the P and the X component for the atoms. So there's of course something of the atom that has to become uncertain when something else becomes certain.
I just like to understand the number of measurements. You have a weak measurement, so therefore you would need a lot of measurements.
Exactly, yes. So this is an important point, that this theory is not something that says, now I measure how many atoms are in that state. This is a scheme in which I say, now I send light through the gas, and then I do a measurement on the light. And this gives me partial information about the atomic system. It doesn't collapse the atomic system immediately. No, that's right, that's important. So here we entangle the two gases. And so as a function of time, we can see a measure for the entanglement grow up, and we can have gases in which we just keep them at rest, and we can have gases, as Eugene has, where he's actually rotating the gases with a Larmor precession. And this gives more entanglement, and the reason is that in that way he actually both squeezes the sum of two observables and the difference of two others. He creates an EPR, a state of his gases, and you probably have heard about those. If you include losses in the system, there's an optimum. So in fact, you can produce lots of entanglement, but if you keep sending light through, the atoms will decay by spontaneous emission. So you're going to lose that entanglement again, and at some point you shouldn't continue probing the system because it becomes decoherent. Now, I would like to, as the last example here, describe the probing of a classical external perturbation on the system. And we picked here a magnetic field. Hideo Mabuchi at Caltech has recently published an analysis of exactly this situation. And it's a very nice example of something which is very complicated. So what is easy is to understand what's happening. You have an atomic gas, you have a B field. That B field causes a spin precession, which is described by the Schrödinger equation for the atomic system. So of course the mean spin is just rotating. Then you send light through, and so there's a Faraday rotation of the polarization, which is proportional to the JC component of the atoms, which in turn depends on the Y component of the magnetic field that you're probing. So this also makes good sense. But when you detect the light, what is then the inferred value of the B field? And what is the error bar on that inferred value of the B field? And the reason this is difficult is that the light detection is a random process. So actually, what you read is a stochastic signal. Because measurements in quantum mechanics work like that. That means that this quantum state is not only evolving continuously due to the B field, it's also evolving stochastically due to the probing. So you have to put that into the system, a stochastic evolution of the atomic state conditioned on your measurement record. And then when you have this stochastic evolution of the quantum state, then you have to say, how does that match with my knowledge about the B field? So in fact, you have a Bayesian update for your probability distribution of the B field, and you have to see what happens to your knowledge about the B field due to this stochastic outcome. So Hideo writes this paper. It's a beautiful paper, and the line of thought is as described here. I think it's beautiful, but it's very difficult, and I wanted to do it, but there were some lines I couldn't reproduce in his paper. So therefore, we came up with another description. But the line of thought is, of course, that given a certain B field, there's a certain probability distribution for your random signal, which is very difficult to compute. But if you know all of these condition probability, you can turn it around using Bayes' formula, and then you get the probability of the B field given the signal you get. But it's a difficult operation. So here's the easy way, which I will present certainly in less than 5 minutes. And so what we do is we treat the atoms and the light and the B field as if they were all part of the big quantum system. So we have now five variables, B, atomic X, atomic P, field X, and field P. And this is my variables describing the system. I have a Gaussian distribution for the atoms and the photons. I will assume an initial Gaussian uncertainty about the B field. And then we have the update formula. And I'm not going to write it again, but we have these gammas. And in fact, it turns out that this is very easy. I mean, everything is just as I described on the previous transparencies. And what you find is that the variance of the B field is, of course, just an element of this big matrix. And here's the analytical expression for the variance of the B field. So you don't look too much at it. Well, then I shouldn't have put it there, I guess. But in the long time limit, this is the way it looks for the uncertainty about the B field goes as 1 over the number of atoms and 1 over time to power 3 over 2. So it's essentially independent of the initial value. Very quickly it loses that dependence. But what is really interesting is that it doesn't scale as 1 over the square root of number of atoms, which is the normal statistical reasoning. And it doesn't scale as 1 over the square root of time, but as 1 over t to the 3 halves. And the reason for this is, of course, that the atoms are getting squeezed. So the probe is gradually becoming a better probe because of the measurement. But a bit like what Markasevich said, we don't want to think of this as squeezing, doing something else. We actually want to look at the end result. And then we can, of course, understand that this end result may have something to do with quantum correlations in the system. But this is a completely objective statement, that this is really what the B field does. And then we can make philosophical statements about why it is so. And of course, squeezing is part of that. So we went on and discussed how to measure several B field components if you want to. Of course, the B field components are classical, so they commute. But since they actually induce rotations of the spins, you have to measure non-commuting spin observables in order to measure two components of a B field. But if you want to measure two B field components, you can cut the same gas in two, and then you can actually make the EPR correlate the state so that the X1 plus X2 for the gases measures one B field, and P1 minus P2 for the other one measures the other B field. So this, I think, is a funny example where it pays to take a simple system, cut it in two, and entangle the two again, and then you get a better measurement. So it's not for doing non-local things. This is actually a local operation which profits from entanglement. If you want to measure three fields, we could only come up with a scheme where you cut the gas in six. So I'm sure the experimentalists in the room are not going to implement this right away. But if you do that, then you can always have four of these gases being sensitive to one of the B field components. And of course, it's just crazy. So take it as an anecdote. But in fact, you can do an excellent B field probing of three B field components with this cutting of the system. Okay, so outlook. First, a statement about the Gaussian state. So many atoms and many photons are easy experiments. Okay, maybe you do not all agree, but if they don't have to be as cold as your atoms, then it's maybe not so difficult. And you have classical fields very often, and homodyne detection is what you have to do. It's also easy theory when you use this Gaussian approach. So we can really do a lot of things. We can readily go to many more samples and more field components and deal with what looked like quantum optical difficult problems a few years ago. We can do squeezing, entanglement, we can do finite bandwidth sources and detection, and all of that is something we can easily put into this theory. And then you can also unify a treatment of quantum systems and classical variables that you want to probe. So here I describe B fields, but it could be inertial effects, it could be gravitation or whatnot. Everything you want to measure, you can put in your uncertainty about it in this big Gaussian state. So outlook two. Well, I didn't talk much about quantum sets, but of course Eugene Poulsik wants to do quantum sets because it's a good physical system for doing this. You have a well-localized system, you have a good optical depth. But you can also go the other way, of course, and use the Gaussian states, which is often done, to describe your Bose-condensed system. So the Bogoliubov theory of excitations is, for example, exactly something that is commensurable with what I'm describing here. You can do probing of the BEC systems, optical probing of these systems. And this has not been done much, but I think it's such an interesting tool. And when you talk about pneumatic order, for example, what happens if at the same time you actually count how many atoms are in one state and another state? Will that influence, stabilize, or destroy, or what will happen to the order you try to make in the system? So a current project we have in my group is to do quantum state tomography on the spatial motion of quantum sets that you can record at different times. So with this, I will say thank you for your attention. Hope I didn't go too far.
There are questions or comments?
Klaus, I'm not sure I understand some of the main message that you try to convey. I mean, are you saying that now there are, So, so the goal is to find out the for if, suppose you have an ensemble of atoms, you want to understand how much squeezing that you have, and the way to detect it is to have a good understanding of the theory of the distribution of the measurements, and then the for both what you call J sub z, and then the fluctuations, and then if under certain situations, certain conditions satisfied, then you conclude that you have a entanglement. Is that a general scheme?
Well, it's one side of it is that you have a good theory actually telling what you measure when you measure something using light. But the important message is also that doing the measurement itself is what creates these interesting states. I mean, it's so easy that it was completely overlooked until 2000 that by sending classical light through gases of atoms and probing the light on the other side would entangle these systems. We had all these crazy schemes, I can say because I've worked on them myself, of making entanglement using fantastic interactions and whatnot. But in fact, what has been proven by Eugene is that it's extremely efficient to just send light through a gas of atoms, and that will immediately entangle the spins inside that gas, or you can entangle several gases with each other. So that's the preparation part, and then the detection part.
Yeah, I have a follow-up question. Since you have mentioned that the EPR state has been created, I'm not too familiar with that, that experiment. But I wonder whether you can comment on the following, whether one could create a entanglement state with an ensemble at long distance. For example, I have many particles up and down. Can I just construct a up, down, minus, plus, down, up, where up means 5,000 particles and down means 5,000 particles, where they are far away with light?
Yes, that's the too ambitious goal. So of course, the kind of entanglement we make here, like the EPR state, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen state, is not the kind of state you refer to. You refer to what we sometimes call a cat state. So and these are not Gaussian this way. In fact, there is a proposal that will allow you to make the kind of state you describe. Also, and distance is really not an issue here because it's really classical lights that we send through fibers, for example, and there's nothing preventing this from being done over kilometer distance. Well, in fact, it's only that you don't afford two labs operating at the same time, so therefore Eugene does everything in the same lab, but he will certainly send his light through kilometers of fiber if you ask him to, and he can do the same thing.
Where is his proposal at the moment to do this?
Yes, absolutely. So this is happening in the lab. The cat state, there's also a proposal how to make something of the kind you describe. Okay, that forces us to leave the family of Gaussian state, but we only do it at the very last moment, so therefore we still have a theory that works for it. But it's no entanglement is it the I was going to jump back here, few transparencies. There's one thing one should not be misled by. I can make fantastic squeezing and fantastic correlations between the gases, but when I have two macroscopic gases, 10 to the 12 atoms, it's not unreasonable that this is a realistic experimental curve giving a Gaussian entanglement information on the order of 2 to 3. It means that the entanglement between those two macroscopic gases is worth 2 to 3 qubits. Okay, so it's disappointing if you think in terms of data transmission using these things. But it's a clear signature in the sense that there are variances that have been reduced by a factor 2 or 3. Okay, so you do the gases. So what Eugene does, demonstrating these things, is you take the gases and to measure if they have this very well-defined sum of x's. Of course, you just measure it. And you see if it has the value you thought it had. And it's always within this very narrow error bar. Hideo Mabuchi is doing similar experiments at Caltech, and it's a very very efficient technique, yes. I usually say to my experimental colleagues that you know, you're making life too easy for Eugene and Hideo by not going into this field, because if they're without competition on this easy topic, I mean, they're eating all the good dough themselves.
Probably to a question in connection to the measurement of B fields. You show that in the purely quantum treatment, you get a fundamental limit that scales with T to the power 3/2.
Yes.
Okay, but, well, magnetic field is, of course, connected to energy, so B squared. I mean, the fundamental limit is Heisenberg's uncertainty, delta E times delta T. So I'm a bit confused. I mean, how does it work out finally? I mean, of course, you can't beat without any pre-preparation Heisenberg's limit of measurement of any energy within time. So the usual behavior is square root of t.
Yes.
Square root of time is nice, because then you do the square, it's delta E times delta T is 1. But here...
I'm talking about here a macroscopic B field. I'm talking about what I call a classical B field, and you can think of it as a B field which is extending in a big, big region of a space. So I think this uncertainty about the total energy present in the magnetic field is I mean, let's admit, and this is the size of this room where we have this B field. So of course the energy available, the B squared terms integrated over this volume, can be big enough that this is not an issue really. But I mean, of course, if you were in a confined space, I guess you're right. Then once you, but then that's another thing. I treat the B field here as only one. Doesn't matter. Work if I point the screen. You see, there's only one B sitting here. If B is an interesting quantum variable, I have to put the conjugate variable to B also here. And then if I do that, and we are in the deep quantum regime, then the measurement of the B field component would induce noise in the corresponding conjugate variable. But here I treat it as a classical variable, making life easier for myself. What's that?
Well.
Okay.
Imagine that with these states that you have prepared, at some point you now make an interferometry experiment.
Yes.
How would you say that the delta B change? I mean, does change? Does improve? Or?
Yes. I mean, so the traditional analysis of clocks and interferometers and the magnetometer and all these things are really based on a sort of statistical reasoning. You measure something, there's an error bar, and then you say, what's the value of the atomic spin? How does that depend on the B field? So you have a derivative, you multiply onto the uncertainty, and then you say, okay, that's my error. What I would really do, because I feel so insecure about this kind of reasoning, I would really include it in this treatment and just see what I get. So in this case, I was surprised, you know. I mean, that the B came out like that. I was not too surprised because Hideo gets the same result, but still, it's by a completely different approach, right? So, imagine a gravitational detection thing. I would simply put my little G here, and then I would see exactly what happens to that. I think statistics is too difficult to put it in my amateur treatment. I have to do it this right way. So this is what I would do. Here, there's a difference between many experiments. Here, of course, we have a continuous probing, so the B field is continuously rotating the spin, and at the same time, we learn about it. If you have an interferometer where you have an interaction with separated regions where you don't measure, then it's a different and perhaps easier analysis.
Klaus?
Yes?
These states are so easy to prepare, these entangled states, but is there any kind of Bell's inequality that you can hope to violate with these states?
That's normally no. I mean, this is what people have been saying about these Gaussian states always. I think you have to do one last step to your systems to do that. So an example of one last step would be a measurement which was not a homodyne measurement, but an intensity measurement. So Philippe Grangier has done this kind of measurement in his group, taking squeezed light and then doing a counting measurement on part of the beam. And immediately he built state where I think he can violate Bell.
But you must finish with some kind of discretized...
You must leave the Gaussian states.
Yeah.
So, I think we still have a few minutes for questions. Otherwise, we thank Klaus again.